Welcome to Lunchtime Legislation with Jack Squared. I'm Jack Spiegel alongside Jack Muscatello.
Welcome to the show.
This is a podcast where we're going to be breaking down the most pressing domestic issues in global affairs. In this episode, we'll be discussing Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination to the Supreme Court. Let's get into it.
Okay, let's start with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Sure. This past week, on March 24th, marked the one-month anniversary of the invasion. And just to break down this past week what happened, we have on March 18th, Ukraine reported that there was a rescue effort of roughly 130 people from the ruins of Mariupol's municipal theater, which was reported to have several hundred more people buried beneath the rubble. And as of today, over 300 people were confirmed killed in the theater. On March 20th, we had Russian airstrikes that destroyed a local art school in Mariupol, and they continued a concentrated assault on the city that is yet to actually fall confirmed to the Russian military, but it is still being heavily assaulted at the moment. March 21st, the Russian government issued an ultimatum to surrender at Mariupol. Ukraine denied this ultimatum, therefore continuing the war effort into the foreseeable future. On March 22nd, Biden expressed concerns about Russia's arsenal of biochemical weapons, which continues that concern about Russia and how they're going to expand if they end up taking Ukraine into NATO territories. On March 23rd, we had reports from inside Ukraine that indicate that the country's resistance has pushed Russian forces away from Kyiv, which is the capital city of Ukraine, which is some positive news for Ukraine's resistance. And on March 24th, we had Ukraine forces that destroyed a Russian supply ship stationed in a southern port. Two other ships around it ended up fleeing, and the Russian military responded by a targeted missile strike in the area, but no confirmed kills of any Ukraine officials. On March 25th, Ukraine officials reported that the city of Chernihiv is now surrounded by Russian officials. So, a big week.
Yes.
Especially the fact that it's the one-month anniversary. A lot of people thought that this was going to be over in a couple weeks.
Right, like early reports had people think that Kyiv would fall within days of the invasion.
And yet we're still here. And because they denied that ultimatum that was delivered by Putin, basically says that this is going to continue for at least a couple weeks.
Right. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier was the strikes and the shelling that destroyed that theater in Mariupol. I think we talked about how there were children, there were women and children that were killed that were in that theater. And one of the things that is just so perplexing to people is that on the outside of the theater, there was children written in big letters that can be seen on satellite images, and yet it was still attacked, right? And it's just one of those things that I saw a report on TV that had that was with the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and he said that they're looking into war crime accusations for both sides, but this was more in relation to those strikes on Mariupol, because it doesn't make sense how governments like Putin's can just get away with atrocious acts like bombing a theater that is housing people who have been displaced because of his actions.
Exactly. Especially they're continuing the effort, Ukraine's government, in writing children or families in big letters on rooftops and on the tops of cars. Especially, there was a story report this morning by CNN of a firsthand account of a family driving their son to one of the largest children hospitals in Ukraine, and they wrote in big letters, child on board, on their roof, which was tragic that they have to go that far, because Russia has changed their strategy to, like you said, attack civilians to kind of cripple, I guess, the Ukrainian will. But it hasn't worked, which is a good thing, especially for the Ukraine resistance, which is mostly based off of civilians anyway.
Right. And especially in a city where that's in the location that Mariupol is, it's for those that don't know, it's towards the southeast of the country. It's a few hundred miles from the Russian border. So it's one of the targets that experts thought would fall within days, but yet people are resilient in Ukraine. And I think they have surprised the world. We still don't know what's going to happen in the coming days and weeks, but it's been pretty incredible through all the horror and destruction that has come out of there, there's a lot of resilience and a lot of hope as well.
And there's people still living in most of the cities, especially Kiev, which is still pretty much not bustling, but there's still regular activity. There's still people walking around outside. There was a couple firsthand accounts on NPR's podcast this morning talking about how one woman who lives in downtown Kiev was going out to get her nails done and was going to get a haircut, and she's just trying to continue her daily life as much as possible, which is a good thing, that they're still able to have some form of normalcy, even amidst the carnage.
Right, and I think the extraordinary courage that Ukrainian President Zelensky has demonstrated, one of his now famous and viral quotes, I guess, was that when the United States offered to get him out of Ukraine, he said, "I don't need a ride, I need ammunition." Right. And it takes a lot for a leader to stand up to a government like Russia, and a leader or dictator like Vladimir Putin. And there are many comparisons between him and Churchill from World War II. And I think that, personally, I think that those are very warranted, and that his courage as a leader and his leading by example is going to be what will make or break the outcome of this war.
Exactly. That brings to an interesting point about how the refugee crisis out of Ukraine is mostly concentrated in Poland. And it was reported today that the numbers, which are not exact, but the estimations put it past most recent refugee crisis, such as from Syria and elsewhere in Africa, and it puts it actually on par with refugees from World War II, which is insane to think about. But
right,
it's
the
up
fact
there.
That, especially because it's only been a month of this,
right. It still feels rather new.
Exactly,
and yet we're already at this milestone. So, and that brings us to the Western response. So we have. In Poland right now, it's kind of a main pathway for supplies and shipments that are being sent by Western nations, kind of through a Lend-Lease program, similar also to World War II. It's the most direct way the U.S. and Britain and several other nations in NATO can respond without direct military action, and Poland has been sort of the number one pathway to do that. Today, Biden is meeting with NATO in Warsaw in Poland. He had been in Brussels earlier this week for a meeting, but landed earlier this morning to meet with some local people who are running refugee efforts, as well as the 82nd Airborne Division of the U.S. military, which is not in active combat. They're just there to help with the refugee situation. But also today, continuing his plan from yesterday, he announced a $1 billion assistance program for humanitarian aid, which I think is pretty important, especially given the fact that it's still just one more of many things that we can do to keep us out of the war directly, but to do as much as we can possibly for the people in Ukraine. We also have Biden, who announced this morning as well, he had a continued press conference, and he said that, quote, the U.S. would accept 100,000 Ukrainian refugees at all costs, which is something that he wanted to really emphasize, especially for domestic relations back here, which are still sort of on the fence as far as what we should do as a country, but he is willing to open our borders up to refugees who need help. And lastly today, he said that to kind of summarize his plans, he said, quote, he wanted to reinforce my commitment to have the United States make sure that we are a major piece of dealing with the relocation of all these folks, as well as humanitarian assistance to people both inside Ukraine and outside Ukraine, which is interesting to see his sort of process of thinking for the future if Russia were indeed to take Ukraine and then move on from that. Because obviously, if they step one foot into any NATO territory, it'll be a lot worse.
Right. And NATO is one of those, the things that I think has a lot of people confused. They're like, oh, why doesn't NATO just accept Ukraine into the treaty organization?
Right.
But it's really, it's such an oddly complex issue that doesn't seem like it on the surface, because Russia has said that if any NATO or any country that is not Ukraine tries to assist them in any way, that they see that as an act of aggression. So countries, especially like the United States, that has such a contentious relationship with Russia, really has, they have to walk a very fine line.
Yes.
Between not doing too much, not directly assisting, which is why I think Biden has refused to send military equipment and fighter jets, which there's been bipartisan support for, but Biden has refused to do that up until this point. But now the accepting of the 100,000 Ukrainian refugees, it's just a matter of how much can be done.
Exactly. And it kind of goes back to how if Russia, again, were to continue their advance, it would kind of force us into more of a response. So I think it's kind of smart on Biden's part to be a little bit more ahead of the curve and say, listen, we have to do this for the sake of the refugees who are displaced currently, but also be willing to ramp up to the next level if Russia decides to impede on any NATO territory, which for anyone who does not know is Article 5 of NATO, which is known as collective defense, which basically means that if any country that is attacking a NATO territory, if they step foot onto another NATO land, or in this case, because Ukraine is not in NATO, if they step foot onto, say, Poland, for example, which is in NATO, that would require all other nations in NATO to respond, which would be a very quick escalation of this issue. But continuing with the indirect response that we have that is as punishing as possible, we have sanctions, which a lot of people, especially judging by Twitter, which is not the best place to go for public opinion. It's great for like first reactions, but mm-hmm. to get any concrete information on there is never a great thing. A lot of people don't really know how sanctions work. So sanctions are penalties that are imposed by one country on another to either stop that country from acting aggressively or to stop them from breaking international law. It usually targets individuals who are in power, such as in this case, Vladimir Putin and his cabinet, as well as potentially specific individuals who are in the private sector in that country, as well as different markets. So right now we have pretty much every Western nation that is of considerable influence placing sanctions on Russia. The US and the UK kind of have led that effort along with the entirety of the European Union in kind of a collective force. So just some examples of the sanctions that have been put in place so far. We have UK and the EU have banned luxury goods sales such as cars, fashion, art pieces, which isn't too crippling, but it's just the start, and that was early on. We also have all Russian flights have been banned from the US, UK, EU, and Canada, which is pretty big, especially for anyone who maybe selfishly wanted to continue business in Russia. We also have sanctions on individual members of the Russian regime, as I said earlier, and top leadership under Putin, which brings up another point about sanctions. I don't know if you want to elaborate on this all in a minute, but sanctions don't respond, or rather, sanctions don't create a response right away. It takes some time. It's crippling in sort of a slow process. And the primary goal, and even if it's not intended, what's going to happen when you put sanctions in place is that you're going to change public opinion in the country you're targeting. And for the sake of Russia right now, you're targeting people who are average civilians in getting Putin out of office. Because the belief is this is Putin's war. There are reports that are some confirmed, some not to be confirmed, but that people in Putin's regime who are under him are not a fan of the war. And if Putin was not in a position of power, that it would be a much different outlook for the Russian war effort right now. So it's kind of been a, I guess, international coverage of this, that this is Putin's game. And if these countries that are joining the U.S. In putting in sanctions are able to convince Russian citizens to vote against him in a potential democratic-style election, which is not the most accurate term, unfortunately, for Russia at the moment. They're not really in any way a democracy. But if they're able to get him out of office at any time in the next year, that will effectively end this aggression.
Yeah, and another thing with sanctions is that not only does, like you were saying, not only does it affect the government and mm-hmm. it's maybe intended to affect the government, but it affects pretty heavily everyday civilians who maybe they're not supporters of Putin's war, mm-hmm. Which brings up the interesting question, are sanctions really, like, do they help in the long run, or are they more just to have a stronger public opinion about the people who are imposing the sanctions, because
that's a good point.
It's interesting because, of course, people who are against Putin's war, who are outside of Russia, are willing to speak up. But there have been numerous people, hundreds of people, that have been arrested because of anti-war protests within Russia. And those people don't necessarily have they don't have the right at all to speak up against this effort. But the United States and other Western countries want those people to be able to have a voice. But it's just, is it really worth dragging the everyday Russian citizens who are anti-Putin and anti the current Russian government? Is it really worth dragging them through the mud?
Right. And especially because you bring up the long-term outlook of sanctions, it isn't pretty. Economically speaking, it takes a long time for the effects to really hammer home, especially jobs in the country. Obviously, we have the majority of Western companies have pulled out their operations entirely. McDonald's famously last week ended up closing over 800 locations, which obviously displaces thousands of people who are working for them in Russia. So it definitely puts families in a difficult position. Obviously in Russia, their income went down as a whole in that country, which reduces their buying of our exports, which is what we wanted, but that also harms us too in the long run when you think about it in terms of our GDP. So it's a concern. And like you said, again, long-term is going to be very interesting to see how it plays out, because right now it's popular to put sanctions in place for us here, for any people such as in Biden's position, for them to say, we're going to put sanctions on Russia. That's a good thing. People like that. But in the long term, we'll see effects. We're even seeing effects now with gas prices. And that's because oil and gas has been banned by both the U.S. and U.K. from our imports from Russia. So we are relying on Saudi Arabia. We're relying on OPEC and any of the countries that are still involved in that. So it's a concern for international sake. So very interesting to see how this will shake out.
Definitely. It'll definitely be a test of the alliances that, especially the United States, but all Western countries have with one another. Because if we can show that we are united against oppression, against authoritarianism, against a dictator, that will quell fears that democracy can't survive in the 21st century, which is what leaders like Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping of China, they have said on the record that they don't believe that democracy can survive in the 21st century. And I think that the Western response and the democracies of the world in whatever form that is, whether that's the United States form of a representative democracy or a parliamentary system, it'll be interesting to see how the next months and weeks and days and years play out in terms of that as well, not just the on the ground in Ukraine.
Right. And when you bring up China, that's a good point too. They haven't explicitly stated whether or not they are against Russia or in support of them. They haven't been quick to deny what Russia has been doing and to put it down. So it's a concern that China is kind of playing the middle ground, and they have the ability to because they have that influence. So I think this will kind of be a turning point for our relationships with other nations that we've kind of just been distant with and not quite allies. This will push it a little over the edge.
Right, like when Biden called Russia and Putin in a worthy adversary back in June when they had their summit.
Right. So that way it was a very sort of casual, not specific division between us, where now it's obviously specific because of Ukraine, and it's only going to get more intense going forward.
Right. I think Zelensky said the other day that it's time for countries to start taking sides, because
yes,
flip-flopping back and forth and saying, we're not going to help until country X does Y or whatever. Like, it's time, and I agree. I think the world needs to start taking sides on things. Otherwise, this is just going to get worse and worse, and it's right now it's only centralized in Ukraine, but there valid fears that it's going to spread outside of there. And the next weeks will be a big turning point for sure.
And he also echoed those concerns again yesterday in a further plea to the NATO conference that will be for the next couple of days in Poland.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and shift into the recent Supreme Court nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was nominated on February 25th by President Biden. This past week, the Senate Judiciary Committee held their hearings for her, and there were some interesting exchanges, to say the least.
Yes, to say the least.
Yeah, some of these just, like, don't make sense. Like, these hearings are intended so that the senators who will vote on her nominate to confirm her nomination in the coming days can get a clearer picture of how she will vote and what kind of a Supreme Court justice she will be. But they have sort of turned into exchanges that, like, made for TV exchanges, which is just not good for anyone.
And it's almost like it's all partisan. I think it's easy to say that just based on the dynamic in the room. But it's become basically a chess match. I think the last couple of times we've seen confirmations, we saw Kavanaugh back, I believe it was in 2017. And we saw Amy Coney Barrett, I believe 2 years ago. And now we're seeing Ketanji Jackson. And it's ploys by, I would say, both sides in a way, who are using the justice in question and the person who's nominated as kind of a point to attack the other side, kind of like a pinball situation. So especially in this case with Jackson, I feel like it's arguably the worst we've seen. Not as dramatic as maybe Kavanaugh's confirmation, but definitely, like you said, some interesting exchanges.
Yeah, like, for example, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, he had multiple exchanges with her. One asking whether or not she thinks a children's book is racist. Another one was asking about whether, if he wanted to become a woman right now and then in 3 hours decide he's not a woman anymore, whether or not he would still have protections under a specific statute. And went on saying, if I'm an Asian man now, and if I'm this and this, it's just like totally arbitrary things that won't have, that have no meaning, and no meaning.
There's no substance
to the confirmation process. It's just so ridiculous. And Senator Ben Sasse, also a Republican but from Nebraska, he floated the idea of banning television cameras from the hearings because he thinks that exchanges like the one with Senator Cruz are causing people to engage in attention-seeking, quote, jackassery, which I don't necessarily disagree with. I think it's important for the public to be able to listen to these because we elected these people to serve and to answer these questions. But he brings up an interesting point on whether cameras really do change the behavior of these people.
Right. And I guess in a way it does, because it's a platform, and I would say especially for anyone in the Republican Party right now after 2020, that it's become a situation where they can use any of these contentious moments to grow their branding. I would say Senator Josh Hawley, who has become well known again after being very outspoken during the 2020 election cycle, he's kind of resurfaced on national news, basically bringing up a point about Ketanji Jackson's history with sentencing. I don't know exactly how many people it was, but I know it was one case in particular of child pornography possession by an 18-year-old. And he brought it up continuously on Twitter, and it kind of stayed on Twitter for a while. And then sure enough, it was brought up this past week in the Judiciary Committee. And it's just an extra layer of political banter in an environment that, like you said, was at one point never perfect, but was only used to check and see if the person who's nominated is qualified for the job.
Right. Like when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was nominated, she got, I don't know the exact number, it was well over 75% yes votes.
Right.
But it has just totally shifted, like you said, to a completely partisan, almost a game. It's mm-hmm. it's a serious topic, but it has turned into a game for the people that we elected to serve us.
Exactly, and it's amplified as soon as something happens. For example, Senator Ted Cruz's moments with Jackson, once it happens, it's on C-SPAN, and then it blows up all over Twitter and just gets amplified from there. And it becomes talking points, you know, like what you bring up. I think there was a great moment with Senator Marsha Blackburn asking Ketanji Jackson if she could define what a woman is. And that was pretty much her direct question, was, can you provide a definition for the word woman? And Jackson, again, because she's been hit with many questions about hypotheticals and what specific terms might mean, she said, I don't want to answer that right now because it's not very important, which it isn't important. And yet that talking point has been spun into an entire debate that's within the Republican Party right now about whether or not being a transgender is acceptable in this country, which is an entirely different conversation. But it's just such an interesting thing that there are people in the Republican Party who are willing to take any of those moments and just blow them up when they're really not that important to begin with. It was just a question. I don't know what Blackburn's intention was with it.
Right, like we're no legal scholars, but we right. both know that there's no real reason to need to know what a woman is
right.
for the purpose of confirming a Supreme Court justice.
Especially when any cases they do see will be more based off of constitutional precedent and potentially changing those precedents and not arguing whether or not it's legal to change your gender, because that would have already been decided. It's just determining if that's constitutional or not. So that would be more of a local issue, not so much on the Supreme Court level. So just a very interesting debate that it almost seems like none of these people know what a Supreme Court justice actually does.
Right.
Which is crazy, but
right. There's a reason that politicians are some of the least trusted individuals yes. in our society, unfortunately, right now.
Which is a shame, especially because they're the first people to hear these cases, especially senators. And I believe on April 4th, which will be a week from Monday, if I have that right, on April 4th, they're going to be voting to confirm Jackson's nomination. And I know we had been doing some research before this, and you brought up an interesting graphic that compares all of the current justices and both their education level and their careers and what they've done so far. And this is courtesy of the Washington Post. And they have basically boxes that summarize each person in terms of their education, whether they went to a public or private high school, an Ivy League law school, and then what they've done their career so far in the legal system. And based off this graphic, I know you can elaborate this a little bit more, Jackson has pretty much, she actually does have every box filled.
Right, yeah. She, one of the most prestigious things for any up-and-coming lawyer, anyone who's in law school, is to be able to clerk for the Supreme Court, which many of the justices have.
Right.
She's the only one, compared to the current justices, she's the only one that was a public defender. She's one of two that was on the Sentencing Commission, one of two that was a district judge. And she, I really think that she has proven herself as someone who is more than worthy of serving on the Supreme Court. Especially the fact that she has been the first Black woman to be nominated to the High Court, which in and of itself is something that is overdue. She's more than qualified for it, but it's she will be a sound voice for the court, and listening to what she's had to say in the hearings has proven that. She's a no BS kind of person. She's not gonna stand for stupid questions from senators, or stupid arguments in cases.
Yeah, she's someone who will be able to take all that experience also and apply it to what her job will be, which is interpreting the Constitution and determining if any cases that enter the Supreme Court through a very elaborate process, if they are constitutional or not, which is, again, her primary goal. So determining whether or not a woman is actually a woman and what that definition is, or going on further about her past and her decisions about specific and very minute cases of child pornography possession. Again, not entirely important. Certainly maybe valid questions, but the way they were handled and obviously the way they were popularized instantly online has not helped the situation be in any way productive.
Right. And one more thing that I want to touch on before we wrap up. First of all, I want to send our thoughts to Justice Thomas, who just this morning was released from the hospital after fighting an infection. But his wife, Jeannie Thomas, has come under fire for some of the text messages she sent with then-President Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, basically asking him to overturn the election and what can be done to overturn the 2020 election to get Trump back into office, which has brought Justice Thomas's his credibility under fire. And it's an interesting debate, and something that that Justice Elena Kagan has told one of the House committees that Chief Justice John Roberts was considering whether or not to adopt a code of conduct that could be applicable to justices, because this is a major conflict of interest, as we all know at this point. There were dozens of legal cases to try and get states to overturn the lawful election of President Biden. And the fact that these cases had good chances of going up to the Supreme Court, and that the Supreme Court refused to even listen to one of the arguments about the election. But had they listened to that, and Justice Thomas been in the position that he was, and this came out, it's just such a blatant violation of ethics. It's just, if your wife is texting the chief of staff of someone who's trying to overturn a lawful election, and you say you can be unbiased about that, I don't know anyone who's going to believe you.
Right. And I will say, based on a CNN report this morning, that Mark Meadows did not appear to be fully on board with what Clarence Thomas's wife had been saying to him. But he did respond. He did provide responses by text. And sure enough, it is a major conflict of interest, even though Clarence Thomas has said in past occasions, because his wife is very well known as a Republican and conservative activist, that he is not influenced by her actions publicly. So then again, it just might be him saving face, but it is definitely a concern when we were very close to seeing cases that could very much so overturn state counts for votes in the 2020 election, that if he were on that in that position, which he would have been, to listen to those cases and provide a judgment, that it would not have been impartial, strictly based on what's presented to him. So definitely a very, very big concern.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if anything more comes out about this.
So we covered a lot today, and a lot has been happening this past week and even just this past month in general. But thank you so much for listening to our first episode of Lunchtime Legislation, and stay tuned for our next episode.
See you later.